ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Jai Vishnubhava Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Stavitara Satsri Srima Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur ki jai. Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai. Prem Sakaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Siddhaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopinatha Shamakunda Radha Kunda Giri Gordhan ki jai. Vrindavan Dham ki jai, Mayapur Dham ki jai, Jagannath Swami ki jai, Ganga Mayi ki jai, Yamuna Mayi ki jai, Tulsi Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki jai. All glories of the assembled devotees, Gaur Prema Nandi, Hari Hari Bol. So, today we're going to read from the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita some verses which are not explicitly philosophical, but of course there's always important philosophy behind them. So the first verse is it up there? There it is. So do you chant that you chant the CC verses?
As you like.
You went on. Yeah, I see it. Thank you. So Hayashirsha, which by the way means horse head. Haya means horse, and Shirsha means head. So, Lord Horsehead, which is actually what it is in Sanskrit. Pancharatra, and of course, Pancharatra means in the Pancharatra. It just literally means five nights. Five nights. And it's a category of literature, Pancharatra literature. I'm going to speak more about it later, but... So the idea is that in the Pancharatra literature, something is said, which we're going to hear about. So, Hayashirsha Pancharatra Kahe Shola Jana. It says, so that book, it said in that book, Shola Jana, 16 personalities. Interesting, anyway, I promise I won't punish you with a lot of linguistics, but Shodasha in Sanskrit means 16. And so you see how it kind of got, not corrupted, but sort of abbreviated into Bengali as Shola, which is Sanskrit Shodasha. So Shodasha Jana, 16 people. Tarmate, so according to this opinion, Kahi, I shall describe, Ebe, now, Chakradi. So chakradi means chakra, etc. The way you say etc. in Sanskrit is that you add adi at the end of a word, which means the group of things whose first member is that. So chakradi means a well-known group of things whose first member in this case is chakra. And of course that well-known group is the chakra and gada, the club, the padma, the lotus, and the shankha, the conch shell. So since everyone knows that group of four things, so you just say chakra. You just say chakradi, that group whose first, adi, is chakra. So I'm now satisfied your burning curiosity about that. And then dharana. Dharana just means caring. Like Prabhupada says, dharma comes from a word, the root dhara, which means to hold or sustain. So this is dharana, holding. So holding the chakra, etc., holding these four symbols. So we'll do this little verse a few times. Hayashirsha Pancharatre Kahe Shola Jana Tharmate Kahi Ebe Chakradi Dharana.
Chakradi Dharana.
Hayashirsha Pancharatre.
Hayashirsha Pancharatre.
Kahi Shola Jana.
Kahi Shola Jana.
Tharmate Kahi Ebe.
Tharmate Kahi Ebe.
Chakradi Dharana. So, ladies, Hayashirsha Pancharatre Kahe Sholajana Tharmate Kahieve Chakradi Dharana. Translation: according to the Hayashirsha Pancharatra, there are 16 personalities. I shall now describe that opinion of how they hold the weapons. Prabhupada's purport: the 16 personalities are as follows. 1. Vasudeva. 2. Sankarsana. If you ever wonder what Sankarsana means, Sang means together, like Sankirtan. And Karsana means pulling, like that. Actually, it's related to the word Krishna, same root as the word Krishna, because Krishna pulls our minds, he attracts us. So that which attracts everything together, holds the universe together, is Sankarsana. So Vasudeva, Sankarsana, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, Keshava, Narayana, Madhava, Govinda, Vishnu, Madhusudana, Trivikrama, Vamana, Sridhara, Hrishikesha, Padmanabha, and Damodara. So, I'll read the other verses, and then we'll see what we can figure out about this. I'm supposed to read up till, 237 to 242? Anyway, we'll just...
242.
Okay. So the next one is Keshava Bhede Padma Shankha Gada Chakradhara Madhava Bhede Chakra Gada Shankha Padmakara. Keshava is described differently as holding the lotus, conch, club, and disc. And Madhava is described as holding disc, club, conch, and lotus in his hands. And of course, these are meant to be understood in a certain order. Narayana Bhede Nana Astra Veda Dhara Ityadika Bhede Sab Astrakara. According to the Hayashirsha Pancharatra, Narayan and others are also presented differently as holding the weapons in different hands. Swayam Bhagavanar Lila Purushottama Edvinama Dhare Brajendra Nandana. Krishna, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead, indicated as the son of Maharaj Nanda, has two names. One is Swayam Bhagavan and the other is Lila Purushottama. Purir Avarana Rupe, Purir Navadeshe, Navavyuha Rupe, Navamurti Prakashe. Lord Krishna personally surrounds Dwarka Puri as its protector in different parts of Puri in nine places. He expands in nine different forms. Actually, it says here, in nine places, in nine vyuha forms, he reveals nine murtis. Chatwaru Vasudeva Dhyā Narayana Nrsinghako Hayagrivo Mahakrodo Brahma Cheti Navodita. The nine personalities mentioned are Vasudeva, Sankarsana, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, Narayana, Nrsingha, Hayagriva, Varaha, and Brahma. Purport. This verse is found in the Laghu Bhagavatamrita 451. The Brahma mentioned herein is not a living entity. That's interesting. Sometimes when there is a scarcity of living entities, Prabhupada, by living entity here means jiva. Sometimes when there is a scarcity of living entities to take charge of Brahma's post, Mahavishnu expands himself as Lord Brahma. This Brahma is not considered to be a living entity. He is an expansion of Vishnu. So, those are the verses.
That's it.
That's it. Any questions? So, I'll make a few comments. And first of all, the Pancharatra literature called Five Nights, and I'm sure there's a reason why it's called Five Nights, but and of course the paradigmatic Pancharatra literature mentioned in the first, actually the third chapter of the Bhagavatam is the Narada Pancharatra. And the Bhagavatam, especially in the the third canto, doesn't the third canto speak about Lord Varaha? I think it's the third canto. But the Bhagavatam mentions several times that there are basically two categories of shastras, which Bhagavatam calls Vaidika and Tantrika. Vaidika is just Vedic. That's how we get Vedic in English. That's from Sanskrit. You make a noun into an adjective by adding a K at the end, an IK. So that's Sanskrit. So we say Vedic and Vaidika. So, interestingly, the word Vedic, as it appears in the Bhagavatam, is used basically in the same way it's used by modern scholars, or really the same way it's been used for a long time in Hindu tradition. That is to refer to the class of literature that we also call Shruti. The Shruti literature, that means the four Vedas, the original explanations of the four Vedas written thousands of years ago called the Brahmana literature. And then you have the Aranyaka literature, people that went to the forest to meditate, to get away from the cities, to get away from ritualistic religion. And they composed books called the Aranyakas, the forest books. And then those forest books, I don't want to say evolved, but then they're manifested you could say more theological books, which were called Upanishads. And so you actually see the meeting ground between these two genres of literature, because the oldest Upanishad is called the Brihad, great, like Brihad Mridanga. The Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. So the Upanishad, which by linguistic analysis is considered the oldest, the Aranyaka Upanishad is the great Aranyaka Upanishad, which obviously shows the moment in which this Upanishad literature became very prominent. One interesting thing about this oldest Upanishad, which is very much Shruti literature, is that there are women gurus in it, which I thought was actually quite interesting. And also, actually, two very prominent women gurus. Amazing how we find such horrible things in the Vedas, but who are Maitreyi and Gargi, two women who become gurus to kings and other prominent people, and to actually debate intelligently with people who are speakers of the Vedas, such as the Yajur Upanishad, Yajurveda, sorry. And by the way, the Sri Yajur Upanishad, just a little fact for you, the Sri Yajur Upanishad is considered very important because of all the Upanishads, it's the only one that's directly part of a Vedic Sanghita. The Sri Yajur Upanishad is actually found in the original text of the Yajurveda. It's the only Upanishad which is directly part of a Veda. Anyway, also these women, another interesting thing about them is that people actually call them by their names. And so that's Shruti literature. You have the four Vedas. You have the Aranyaka literature. Of course, the Brahmanas, the ancient commentaries. By the way, the oldest Veda, or at least in terms of scholarly analysis, is the Rig Veda. And the name of each Veda actually tells what's inside of it. So Rig in Sanskrit means a verse or hymn. And so in all these great Vedic sacrifices, there are two kinds of Vedic sacrifices. We always say Vedic culture, so why not learn a little bit about what that original culture was? There were two kinds of sacrifices, what were called, you could say, state sacrifices. The grand sacrifices like Ashwamedha or Rajamedha and others. And these sacrifices were so elaborate and so expensive that only a government could actually afford to put one on. And so these are the great sacrifices. And called the Shrota sacrifices, the sacrifices that are directly in the Vedas. And then there are the Griha sacrifices, because Brahmanas and other educated or civilized people would perform small-scale sacrifices in their home. So it's called Griha, the domestic sacrifices, such as an Agnihotra, or just a little fire that you would keep and offer, like householders do today. Of course, we have an altar rather than a fire, and you know, people, not only householders, offer their food and so on. So the altar, in a sense, functions the way the domestic fire used to function. Interestingly, that's why Krishna says in the Gita, have you ever wondered that first verse in the sixth chapter, that those who are really renounced continue to perform their duties, not those who are near Agni, who have no fire. In other words, even if you become a renounced person, you still perform these duties. Also, another interesting point, since I'm just going over this, is that in chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives a very interesting list of ways in which you can perform these sacrifices, fire sacrifices, without a physical fire. It's a whole section of the Gita where Krishna says, for example, that make the senses the fire, and they offer the sense objects into the senses. Some people make the mind the fire, and they offer the sense experiences into the mind, and so on. So it's very interesting that even thousands of years ago, when Krishna appeared, some people are not inclined to actually go through all these rituals, but what they adopted is the principle of offering. The principle of offering. The principle that you have to offer, ultimately, yourself to God. That we have to offer ourselves to God. We have to worship God. However, you don't have to perform the ritual fire sacrifices. You can do it through yoga, through meditation, through sense control. And Krishna gives a whole catalog of yajna options. You know, there's something for everybody. So, anyway, maybe just a couple more points about this, about fire sacrifice, because we always talk about it. And that is that, how did it actually work? Because we hear about people performing fire sacrifice and producing amazing results, like, for example, all kinds of powers, or Drupada, when he was offended and insulted by Drona in the Mahabharata, he could not tolerate it, so he found two great Brahmins, Yaga and Upayaga. It's a common thing in Sanskrit that a younger brother is like Yaga and little Yaga. Yaga and Upayaga, and you actually find this. Krishna has one of those little brother names. Anyone know what that is? Krishna took birth as Vamana, the brother of Indra, the little brother of Indra. So there's Indra and little Indra, which is Upendra. Upa Indra. That's what Upendra means. Anyway, so he performed the sacrifice, and out came from the fire came Dhristadyumna, this fiery warrior, and then from the fire altar itself came Draupadi. Came Draupadi. So how did that work? Like, how do you get all these things? One more thing about the Vedas, I thought I would mention, is that unlike in the Upanishads, in each category of Vedic literature, there's a different aspect which is crucial in order to actually take advantage of that literature. So, for example, the Mahabharata or the Puranas, the important thing is the Mahabharata especially, it is the story itself. The story is important, not the precise language. In the Upanishads, it's the philosophy that's important. But in the Vedas, the power was actually in the sound of the words. So it was the sound itself that held the power. And of course, this is illustrated by a very famous story which is given in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam. And that is when the demigod Tvashta, his son, what was it, Vishwarupa, who had three heads. No jokes about that. So Vishwarupa had three heads. And so with one head, he was making offerings to the devas to empower them. With another head, he was offering to the forefathers. But with another head, he was offering to the asuras because he had some relatives who were asuras. And Indra found out about this and killed him. Tvashta was very unhappy that Indra killed his son and decided to do a fire sacrifice to create this powerful being that would kill Indra, that would become the mortal enemy Indra. And this story is given, among other reasons, in the Bhagavatam, this sixth canto, to illustrate how important it was to get the sounds correct. The power was in the sound. So at one point, with all these mantras, Tvashta had to say Indra Shatru. Shatru means mortal enemy. So Indra Shatru, with the accent on Sha, would produce this powerful being who would be the mortal enemy of Indra. In other words, would kill Indra. But, you know, I don't have to tell you, these fire sacrifices can become kind of tiring, all the smoke and all the mantras. And so Tvashta was distracted, and instead of saying Indra Shatru, he said Indra Shatru, which means just by shifting the accent to the first syllable, it had the opposite effect. The sacrifice produced this being of whom Indra would be the mortal enemy. In other words, Indra would kill him. So that's just to show you how powerful, how important, it was actually the language, and that's why it was memorized. I remember at Harvard, my professor, who was one of the world's leading, I know it sounds funny to us, Vedicists, he studied the Vedas, he always said that it was the greatest feat of memorization in human history, because the Rig Veda is a very, very long book, and they actually memorize it down to every little accent. Anyway, so all that literature. Oh, by the way, one other thing, I just keep thinking of things which I think are relevant if you are a member of the Hare Krishna movement. And that is Ritwik. You may have heard this word Ritwik, and so I thought I would explain what the word actually means, since the people who advocate it have no idea what the word means in Sanskrit. And the word is mentioned in the context of Vedic fire sacrifices. The word Ritwik actually comes from two words. The first is Ritu, which actually technically would be Urtu. That's the vowel R, actually. Sort of like Hershey bar or curd. Anyway, no phonetics here. So Ritu means season, summer, fall, winter, spring. So Ritu actually means season. And Ij is simply in Sanskrit an abbreviation of the Sanskrit root yaj, which means to sacrifice, like yajna or yagya, or however you pronounce it. So, Ritu Ij literally means sacrificing in season. That's what the word actually means. Because in India, in the Vedas, and all around the world, in the Greco-Roman ancient times, in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, all over the world, they performed sacrifices, fire sacrifices, because Vedic culture was spread in many places. And these sacrifices were performed according to the agricultural calendar, because people lived. I mean, Krishna himself says in Bhagavad Gita, "Anad bhavanti bhutani." Creatures exist from food. Creatures exist from food, and so therefore, it was very much an agrarian society back then, and so all the sacrifices were performed. All the sacrifices were performed according to the agricultural calendar. So there'd be sacrifices to prepare the ground, to plant the seeds, to harvest, and so on. And it was a duty of the government to protect the people and maintain economic prosperity by carefully performing these sacrifices. Just like nowadays, world leaders go to different countries and they always talk about economics and things and, you know, other things. So these sacrifices were so elaborate, so technical, required such it was like the equivalent of a PhD or more, required and completely expert knowledge of Sanskrit, of pronunciation. And so therefore, a highly qualified person who actually had mastered the innumerable details of sacrifice so that it didn't blow up in your face was called a Ritu Ij, the one who sacrifices in season. That's what the word actually means. The J turns to K. You'll be fascinated to learn by Sanskrit phonetic rules. Anyway, but the word is actually Ij from Yaj. So, Ritwik has absolutely nothing to do with gurus. It has absolutely nothing to do with surrogacy. It has absolutely nothing to do with any of that. It's actually, anyway, said enough. But that's, since we're talking about Vedic culture, so all of these things, the Rig Veda is the book that has all the hymns in it. The Yajur Veda is the Yajur book. It's knowledge of Yajur. And Yajur in Sanskrit means how you do the sacrifices, what the meaning is of the sacrifice. And so that the Yajur Veda, its name explains what's inside of it. And interestingly, in the Yajur Veda, which gives the Yajungsi, the plural of Yajur, all the explanations of sacrifice, that's the Veda in which you find the famous phrase Yajna Vai Vishnu, that the sacrifice is Vishnu, and Vishnu is the sacrifice. By the way, in the oldest commentary, on the oldest Veda, the Rig Veda, and by the way, this is described in the Bhagavatam twice. In the first chapter and the last chapter of the Bhagavatam, it's explained how Vyasa divided the Vedas and then assigned them to different Brahminical communities. So the Vedas and all their explanatory literature, they were preserved and handed down in very strict Brahminical communities. And these, and again, this is described in the Bhagavatam. In fact, it's described exactly to which sage Vyasadeva gave each of the four Vedas and so on. And then it says Shishai, Tatshishai, and so on, that how they gave it to all their disciples. So this was the process described in the Bhagavatam explicitly, which produced the category of Vedic literature called the Brahmin literature. It's described in the Bhagavatam. And in the oldest commentary on the oldest Veda, the oldest Veda is the Rig Veda, at least according to literary analysis, it's the hymns. And the oldest commentary on the Rig Veda is called the Aitareya Brahmana, because it was within the community of Atri Muni. And in the very first verse, it's like 1.1.1.1, because there's all these different categories. The very first verse of the oldest commentary and the oldest Veda is, of all the gods, Vishnu is supreme. Vishnu is the highest. I actually mentioned that one time to my professor at Harvard, and he said, yeah, that's right. So, how did the sacrifices work? Not in a way which is not very different from your computer screen, which I'll explain. So in the great Vedic sacrifices, well, first of all, the philosophical or ontological principle, how could so many things be produced by sacrifice? The essence of it is, all set there? The essence of it is that Krishna is everywhere and everything is within Krishna. So if Krishna is everywhere and everything is in Krishna, what that means logically is that everything is everywhere. Think about that. Everything is everywhere. Because Krishna is everywhere and everything is in Krishna. So through Krishna and not without Krishna, everything is everywhere. And because Vishnu is the sacrifice, he is the, in other words, the sacrifice sort of manifests Vishnu, or he agrees to manifest. So within the sacrificial performance, everything is everywhere. And therefore you can access anything. And so in the great Vedic sacrifices, there were actually three fires. One fire was for the devas, the higher planets. Another one was for the forefathers. Another one was for the earth. And so the Vedic sacrificial arena is actually a computer screen with icons representing the universe. It's actually a type of... So the macrocosm becomes cosmic. So within those three fires, the whole universe is actually present there. And so therefore you can do all kinds of amazing things. So I mention all that just because we always hear about Vedic literature, but that's actually what's going on there. And of course, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that Vedais cha sarvair hameva vedyo, by all the Vedas, I alone am to be known. So it all culminates in Krishna. So, now, we also find in the Brahma Samhita, and this gets to the point of the verse, you see, you may have thought that because of my advanced age, I forgot the topic. But actually, I remember it. Oh, it's not there. Anyway, so now I'm going to go right back to the topic. And that is that it's said in the Brahma Samhita that Vedeshu Durlabham, it is hard to find Krishna in the Vedas. Vedeshu durlabham. Adurlabham, it is not hard to find Krishna. Atma bhakto, in devotion of your soul. If you have real love for Krishna in your soul, not just in your mind, atma bhakti, then it's not hard to find Krishna. So, and Krishna himself, I mean, most of the things Krishna says about the Vedas in the Gita is derogatory. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. Like, for example, he says, he tells Arjuna that Trigunya Vishaya Veda, the Vishaya, the subject matter, the focus of the Vedas is Trigunya, life in the three modes, which is sort of the Gita's way of saying material life, Trigunya, from Triguna. Or Krishna says, Yangimang Pushpitang Vacham, Prabhadanti Napandita, that the panditas, the wise, do not recite the flowery words of the Vedas. And then Krishna says again, that's in chapter 2, then Krishna says in chapter 9 that, what do those verses say, that trividya, sutapa, trigunya, yes, very good, trividya, somapa, putapa, pa, so, slowly. Thank you, very good. Getting rusty. So, which means that Trividya means those who are expert in the Trividya, the three knowledges. Trividya, and that's Trividya, which means the Rig, Sama, Yajur, Veda. The Atharva Veda was often excluded from this list because it's kind of the voodoo Veda. I mean, it has wisdom also, but it also, like, you know, if your neighbor stole your cow or something, you can chant this mantra and, you know, something bad will happen to him or something. So the Brahmins and the mode of goodness kind of, they talk about, even Krishna talks about the three Vedas, even though there actually are four Vedas. So And it's not all that. I mean, some of it is a little better. So Krishna says, Somapa, who have drunk the soma, Putapapa, freed of their sins, Swargating Prarthayanti, they aspire to Swargating, going to material heaven. And then Krishna, of course, says, Gata, Gatam, Kama, Kama, Labhante. All these people who are Kama, 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 because just like in English, you can say the word wish or desire can be a verb or the object of the verb. For example, you can wish for wishes. Like if a genie comes out of your loda. I guess in Vedic culture, genies come out of lotas, right? Anyway, so you say I'll give you three wishes. So wish can, and you also find this play on words, by the way, in the Damodar prayers in the fourth stanza. So you can wish for something or you can have a wish. And that's exactly what Krishna is saying. Kama, kama, those who wish for their wishes, or those who, in other words, those who desire. All they get for their trouble is gatagatam, round trip ticket. You go and you come back. Gata means going and agata means coming. They go and come, no progress. So most of what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita about the Vedas is not very flattering, because he's taking the Vedas to mean the Karma Kanda Shruti literature. But then again, ultimately he says, by all the Vedas I'm to be known. In any case, because there's some of the most important aspects of our philosophy, in fact, are not found in the Shruti literature, such as Vaikuntha Loka, or Krishna Loka, such as the plenary expansions of Krishna, like Vasudeva, Sankarsan, Pradyumna, Niruddha, that whole idea of Krishna's plenary expansions, the spiritual world, deity worship. So if you think about it, or elaborate descriptions of the forms of Krishna, the symbols he's holding, basically exactly what these verses are talking about. These things are not found explicitly in the Shruti literature. Therefore, the Bhagavatam emphasizes that, and that's what these verses are about. So we're actually coming to the topic, because I wanted you to know what we're talking about with Shruti, that these verses are describing the deity forms of Krishna, or simply not only deity forms, but the actual Vaikuntha forms of Krishna, the objects he's holding in his hands, and so on. And this is Pancharatra. This is the other category of literature. There's Shruti literature, and there's Pancharatra literature, which is also called, in the Bhagavatam, it's also called Tantra literature. You should not confuse this with the evil hippie Tantra, which arose in India, which involves incest, intoxication, and it's hippieism. Actually, you find it in India many centuries ago. It's the rather stupid idea that the way to be liberated is break all the rules, because rules are limiting you. So therefore, break all the rules, and that's liberation. Of course, if you apply this in real life, it doesn't work. Like, you could be driving on a road. Why should I be confined and restricted by this road? I'm going to drive whatever I want. So you turn off the road and go into a swamp, and that's the end of your trip, and perhaps the end of your life. So actually, staying on the straight and narrow, as they say, following the path takes you safely to your destination. Anyway, so that tantra was a later tantra. It's, I think, objectively disgusting. And that's not what the Bhagavatam is talking about when the Bhagavatam says, tantram satutam achastam. In the third chapter of the first canto of the Bhagavatam, Narada Muni's qualification to be listed as an avatar is that he taught tantra literature. The word tantra, Vaishnav tantra, satutam, Vaishnav tantra, comes from the root tan, which means to extend or expand. As in the first verse of the Bhagavatam, Tene Brahma Hrida, Jaadi Kaviye, that the Lord extended Vedic knowledge into the heart of Brahma, Tene, that's the past tense. Tra just means an instrument for accomplishing something. So Tantra literally means an instrument to accomplish the expansion of Vedic knowledge. And so the Bhagavatam mentions several times that you cannot really understand God unless you have both Vedic literature used in a more technical sense, Shruti literature, but also Tantrika, Tantra literature, which the Bhagavatam, the glory of the Bhagavatam, is that it is a supreme combination of these two. In the most powerful way, it integrates these two categories of literature. So that in the Bhagavatam, you find all Vedic knowledge. In fact, there's one chapter in the second canto, which Prabhupada puts as a title, Purusha Sukta Confirmed. And why? Because that whole chapter of the Bhagavatam is a very learned, authoritative commentary on the Rig Veda. Specifically, the 10th book of the Rig Veda, which presents the Purusha Sutra. So the Bhagavatam, and also the Bhagavatam begins, right, that Janmadhyasya Jataha, which is Vedanta. So the Bhagavatam perfectly presents the essence of Shruti literature, because by all Shruti literature, Krishna is to be known. And it also gives this equally authoritative, sort of supreme Smriti literature or Tantra literature, and it describes the incarnations of Krishna, and it describes also worshiping the deity, it describes the spiritual world. So the Bhagavatam is it gives it all. It's the supreme Shastra, as the Bhagavatam itself often reminds us. So anyway, going to these verses, so why does the Chaitanya Charitamrita... Now, one interesting thing about the first verse I read, which is 237, I think. Yes. Is that tarmate. Tar in Bengali is just Sanskrit tasya, its, like its opinion, in its opinion or his opinion. In this case, its opinion means in the opinion of this book, which is being cited. So, and mata can mean opinion, thought. It comes from the root man. That's where you get the word manas, mind. So from the same root, manyate, he or she thinks or considers or has an opinion on something. Krishna in the Gita always says, in my opinion, you know, which means don't disagree. So here, tarmate, in the opinion of this book, but it's very interesting because if you look at how Prabhupada uses the word opinion, I actually did a study of this, it's in a paper I wrote. Prabhupada uses the English word opinion in two very different ways. On the one hand, there's a whole list of statements from Prabhupada in which, for example, he's giving a lecture, someone asks a question afterwards, well, in your opinion, woo, Prabhupada would just, you know, their head would roll. It is not my opinion. It is not a question of my opinion. This is the fact. So there's all these statements from Prabhupada saying, I never gave my opinion. When did I ever give my opinion? It is not a question of opinion. However, if you actually look at those statements carefully, what we find is that every time Prabhupada says something like that, denies ever giving his opinion, he's talking about statements that come directly from Shastra, from Krishna, from the Bhagavatam. And there's a whole other group of statements of Prabhupada where he says, well, that's just my opinion. Or in my opinion, I have my opinion, but you may have a different opinion. He says the exact opposite. Prabhupada says, I never gave my opinion. And then he says, often, well, in my opinion, but that's just my opinion. So why? Because this is called a paradox. A paradox means an apparent contradiction which can be resolved and understood if you think more. It's sort of like a literary speed bump. It forces you to slow down and think. So whenever Prabhupada says, this is my opinion, he's talking about material things. And if you think that Prabhupada knows everything about material things, Prabhupada himself says, that is ludicrous. That's a direct quote from Prabhupada. The word ludicrous in English means so absurd as to be comical. And that's the word Prabhupada uses. So just as Prabhupada said, if the guru asks for water, don't bring milk. If Prabhupada asks for theological water, don't bring him theological milk. We should not fall into the trap of thinking that we should understand everything through Prabhupada's teachings, except one thing we don't accept through Prabhupada's teachings, and that is Prabhupada himself. So Prabhupada gave us perfect spiritual knowledge, and one of the topics that Prabhupada elaborately explains is Prabhupada. And of course, sometimes if you actually take Prabhupada seriously, you're considered to be offensive. But that's another topic. But here, and I mentioned all that because here Prabhupada says, in the opinion of this Shastra, Prabhupada does not say that this Hayashirsha Pancharatra, he doesn't say it's infallible divine truth. He said, in its opinion. And so what you find if you study the commentaries of the Acharyas is that they disagree on certain details like this, but they never disagree on what is called Siddhanta, or the fundamental philosophical points. And, I mean, there are innumerable cases where Acharyas just debate each other on these things, but they never debate each other on Siddhanta. By the way, the word Siddhanta, which is used in Lord Chaitanya's mission, if you read the Bhagavatam, a different Sanskrit word is used. It means the same thing, and that is tattva. So if you read the Bhagavatam, starting with the first chapter, it said that the guru's service is to give tattva. Krishna says it in Bhagavad Gita, upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tattva darshina, seers of the truth. So the word tattva is translated as truth, but there are different words for truth in Sanskrit. Satya, for example, means it's true, it's not false. That's the word satya, or satyam. Tattva means a fundamental category of real thing, a fundamental categorical truth, as Vishnu tattva, jiva tattva. No one says jiva satyam or Vishnu satyam. It's tattva, and that's what a guru teaches you. Fundamental categorical truth. And if you don't understand the categories, then you are nirvishesha, as in Prabhupada's pranam mantra. Vishesha in Sanskrit means a distinction, a difference, like Veda. So if you confuse the tattva categories, if you think that Krishna's body is material, that is a category mistake. It is a tattva mistake, because you've confused Vishnu tattva and Prakriti tattva. If you think that you are God, that's an obvious category mistake. It's a tattva mistake. And so on and so forth. Or if you think you are your body, that's a category mistake. So a bona fide guru knows the fundamental categories of reality, which are called tattva, you know, vedanti tattva vidang, tattva mya, and so on. But that's the word. So I'll wrap up here. And so this knowledge, and we could talk also, but I won't, because you know, it's sort of Vaishnava aparad to delay people's breakfast. So, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But also the very fact that we have all these descriptions of Krishna's different forms and the symbols, it's a unique level of spiritual knowledge, and a lot can be said about that, like what are these symbols in Vishnu's hands and so on. But I'll stop here. So any questions quickly? Yes, Bhadraji.
Thank you, Maharaj. You explained nicely about the sacrifices. Krishna is everywhere. Krishna is in everything. And people used to perform these sacrifices in different yugas. So can you elaborate? Because in this Kali Yuga, we are saying the Sankirtan is the Chakya.
Yes, yes. Chakya.
But then, of course, we understand as a practitioner of Krishna consciousness, because Lord Chaitanya says his second shloka,
Nam
Namakari Bhavatani Sarva
Shakti. It's the same principle of sacrifice, because when you
Maharaj, when you go outside, talk to people,
yes,
they say, you guys are keep chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. I mean, why, you know, how does that you know, they ask a question. So how can we actually explain
it's the same principle.
Yes, chanting is...
Well, you have to, you know, Prabhupada said to Professor Stahl in that debate they had in 1970, he was a very prominent Indologist at UC Berkeley. And Prabhupada said, kirtan also means to talk about, to speak. So when you, like right now, we are engaged in Sankirtan. Right now, we are engaged in Sankirtan as much as when we chant. That's also Sankirtan. And so therefore, it is the duty. Narada Muni, when he was instructing Dhruva how to worship the Lord in the fourth canto, he said that you have to worship Krishna desha kala vibhagavit, understanding differences of place and time. That's fourth canto, chapter 8, text 54, in which Prabhupada actually says that that those who are puffed up with concocted notions, Prabhupada's exact words, those who are puffed up with concocted notions think that in the Western countries, you can do this exactly as in India. Those are Prabhupada's words, puffed up with concocted notions. And I could give a, you know, 1,000 other quotes from Prabhupada. But anyway, leave it at that. So it is our duty to follow the Acharyas, because if you look at the history of our tradition, Vaishnav tradition, the great Acharyas, Prabhupada and his predecessors, it is a history of adaptation of external principles. I mean, I've explained this so many times. I won't go into all the details. It is a history of adaptation. And so if someone does not adapt, how are they following the Acharyas? And of course, what we adapt is the details, not the basic principles. We don't change the basic principles, and we know what the basic principles are because Prabhupada taught them, and Rupa Goswami taught them in chapter 6 of the Nectar Devotion. But as far as details, external details, how we present Krishna's holy names, how we present the glories of Krishna, Prabhupada said those were not actually fit to act in that role cannot find the way to adapt, and therefore they don't get wide results. So it is our duty to Prabhupada. That same phrase, desha kala vibhagavit, is found again in the Bhagavatam. In the first canto, it's used to describe Bhishma on the bed of arrows. He understood differences, distinctions of place and time. So Prabhupada said, tax your brain, find a way. One great example is Tamal Krishna Goswami, who went to China. I mean, no one could have, well, among Prabhupada's disciples, who could have done that? He had to adjust so many things in terms of his dress, this and that and the other thing. But he was successful. Now there are thousands of Chinese devotees. Anyway, so that's our job. Prabhupada was looking for moons. You know, it's time to go lunar here. What Prabhupada really needs at this point in history is that his followers, disciples, grand disciples, whatever, doesn't matter where you are. I mean, it's a complete illusion to think that because I was initiated by Prabhupada, therefore automatically I have a closer relationship to Prabhupada. That's actually not true, because if it were true, it leads to an absurd conclusion. Prabhupada, in the way he presented himself to important people, to the public, if you look at his letters, he would say, founder Acharya. Prabhupada did not order that the words Diksha Guru of ISKCON be put on his books. Founder Acharya. Why? Because there can be many gurus. There are many gurus in ISKCON, but there's only one founder Acharya. And so Prabhupada, of course, he performed the task of Diksha Guru, just as he did everything else for us. But the title that he insisted on, and that he actually kicked some of his senior devotees out of the movement for messing with that title, was Founder Acharya. And as Founder Acharya, everyone in the Hare Krishna movement has the same access to Prabhupada. I do not have a greater access to Prabhupada as Founder Acharya because he initiated me. I will have a greater access if I'm more serious in my service. If you are more serious in your service to his mission, you will have a more intimate relationship with Prabhupada. So obviously to have that access to Prabhupada, you have to do your duties. One of the duties is to honor one's guru. However, if it were the case that I automatically, just by being initiated by Prabhupada, I mean, please, you can't stop the etiquette. I do get to butt in line for prasadam, you know, because I'm a Prabhupada disciple. But that's just, you know, that's etiquette. But if it were true that I automatically have a more intimate relationship with Prabhupada, being his initiated disciple, and you, if you're a grand disciple or a grand or whatever, then that would lead logically to the conclusion, the necessary conclusion, that every succeeding generation of devotees in ISKCON is getting farther and farther away from Prabhupada. That is an absurd conclusion. And so therefore, everyone, every living being on this planet has exactly the same opportunity to know Prabhupada, to get his mercy, to have an intimate relationship with him. In fact, sometimes I think the younger devotees have an advantage. Because, for example, I've driven across the Rocky Mountains. And so when you're actually driving through the Rocky Mountains, they don't look that high because the road is so high. I mean the interstate is like sometimes 10,000 feet up. And so you may be driving through peaks that are, you know, maybe 12,000 feet. They just look like hills. It's when you come out of the mountains and you go maybe 20 miles away and then look back, then you actually see it. Then you see the majesty, the power of the mountains. So sometimes you can be so close to something that you can't quite see it. And sometimes it's the people who have greater distance that understand it better. So therefore, every one of us, it also is totally irrelevant what kind of body you have. It's not about gender, it's not about race, it's not about age, it's not about who your Diksha Guru is. It's simply about your willingness to not live a selfish life, your willingness to actually put yourself out there for Prabhupada. That's all, that's the whole thing. The rest is just, is not relevant. Any devotee, doesn't matter, man, woman, young, old, doesn't matter, anyone who's willing to really devote their life to Prabhupada's mission, not to rituals, but to his mission, can get his full mercy, can become a great Vaishnava, can become most dear to Prabhupada. Any one of you, any devotee in the world, can become most dear to Prabhupada if they actually go out and do the work. So, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Wait,
can I ask you this last question, please?
Sure, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
You said that everything is in Prabhupada's books and we should accept everything, but one thing, we should not accept Prabhupada.
No, I said some people think that way, but that's wrong.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, should have made it more clear.
Glad you clarified that.
Yeah. I'm saying that that's absurd. And so I've written a paper on that, explaining, quoting Prabhupada in great detail, quoting Shastra, quoting everything to show the you know, how we're supposed to take the pure devotee. Some people think that the paradigmatic pastime which shows how to approach Krishna is the Brahma Vimohana Leela, when Krishna bewildered Brahma and Krishna took the place of the calves and cowherd boys. So that actually they looked like calves. So if it were true that every word Prabhupada said is actually directly Krishna speaking, and everything Prabhupada did is directly Krishna acting, that would lead necessarily to the conclusion that we know absolutely nothing about Prabhupada. We never heard Prabhupada's voice. We never actually saw him do anything. Because it was just Krishna using his body. So that when you fully surrender to Krishna, that's the last free act you ever perform. Which is absurd, which is actually impersonalism. So a pure devotee means that you have pure love for Krishna. It doesn't mean you don't have your personality. Prabhupada said Krishna wrote these books. That's true. But Prabhupada also said many times, and I've quoted this, that these are my books. I wrote these books. So A pure devotee doesn't mean they... It's not that in the spiritual world, Krishna is just talking to himself through, you know, trillions of spiritual bodies of devotees just surrendered and, you know, and they're not actually talking to each other. They don't have relationships with each other. It's just Krishna talking to himself through all these surrendered bodies. So the pure devotee does have a personality. He does have preferences. Prabhupada once said that he would rather die than eat, you know, food that wasn't cooked in ghee. He said it in Denver in a morning walk. I mean, obviously he was speaking for, you know, just like devotees were saying, Prabhupada, you know, it's much healthier if you only eat boiled food. Prabhupada said, I'd rather die. So Prabhupada reserved the right to be a real person. And the more you advance in Krishna consciousness, the more of a person you become, not the less of a person you become. So, I mean, all these things need to be cleared up a bit. Anyway, thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.